Cats in Hell, a look back at Saturday Night Live with your hosts, Matt and Keith. Brought to you by Lion's Den Audio Theater. Like and subscribe to Lion's Den Audio Theater for more Lion's Den goodness. And here are your hosts, Keith and Matt.
Saturday Night Live, Season 4, Episode 9, starring Elliot Gould, originally aired on December 16th, 1978. Ho, 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 and welcome to SN Hell. This is the Christmas episode from 1978, also our last episode of 1978. The star is Elliot Gould. Musical guest is Peter Tosh. My name is Keith, and with me, as always, is my good buddy Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Keith. Happy holidays.
Tidings of the season, my friend. How are things?
Pretty good, thanks. It's a nice chilly evening. I'm sitting around by the tree with my mug of eggnog.
Very good, very good. With your, what was it, your nuts in the fire, as you would say?
Yes, previously. Exactly.
Joining us tonight again, always a joy, it's Adrian. Hello, Adrian.
Hello, hello, and season's greetings to you both.
Happy winter wonderland to you both. Our host tonight, Elliot Gould. This is his fourth time joining us. His most recent work at this point was a Canadian film called The Silent Partner. It was a suspense movie. It was a big, big hit. Beloved by critics, and it co-starred Christopher Plummer, Susanna York, and both John Candy and Tony Rosato of SCTV. Rosato, later of SNL, had small roles. Have either of you ever seen The Silent Partner?
Sure haven't. Didn't even know it existed.
Likewise, I'd never heard of it, but with a cast like that, I might have to check it out.
It's apparently an amazing movie. It's, you both heard of the 1970s Canadian film tax shelter thing that brought all these movies to Canada?
Yep.
This is often regarded as the best of all of them.
Very cool. I'll have to check it out.
Which may or may not be saying something. A lot of them were terrible. My old acting teacher used to appear in a lot of these, and he said a lot of the time they'd come up, they'd cast about 15 Canadians in roles that could be cut. So you'd get your Canadians in the movie, you'd get them paid, and then their scenes would all be cut. You know, just a random psychiatrist or like a mailman that delivers a package that isn't really important, that sort of stuff. Our musical guest is Peter Tosh. Have either of you ever heard of Peter Tosh before tonight?
I've heard of him. I don't know it very well, not at all.
Adrian? I've heard of him because of his connection to the Wailers.
Yeah, that's the only way I'd have heard of him before. Before seeing them here, yep. We also have guest appearances by a comedy duo of Bob and Ray. Were either of you familiar with Bob and Ray?
I was not, but I thoroughly enjoyed them.
I know of a Bob Ray.
Former premier of Ontario. We'll talk about them in a bit, but they're probably among the most influential comics of the last 100 years without them making a lot of the lists of the most influential comics. We'll talk a bit about Bob and Ray as we get to them, but I was delighted. I forgot that they came. I actually think their appearance was cut out of the syndicated version I once saw. And in the formation of this show, there was a lot of talk about Bob and Ray. So I was glad to see them here. And we're going to see them again later in the season for a special they do with Jane, Lorraine, and Gilda. Yeah, stay tuned on that one. Last week, Mr. Mike was announced as appearing in this episode. He's not here, and I couldn't find out why. A little bummed out not to have Mr. Mike tonight. Matt, I'm sure you're the same.
Yes, always welcome an appearance. I'd be curious to know what's up myself.
So this is the holiday Christmas special. It was also a very busy news week, which we'll cover as we go on. A lot of stuff happening in the world. But let's jump right into the cold open. There's quite a bit to go through tonight. So we begin with a bumper. The 28th annual U.S.-Taiwan Table Tennis Open won't be seen in order to bring a message from the White House lawn from the President Jimmy Carter. Aykroyd, of course, comes out as Jimmy Carter. He does a few small waves to the audience. It gets a huge applause. The audience is just loving him. He says it's his fourth time on TV that week, and he's beginning to feel like Merv. He is there to actually talk about energy, and experts believe that they do have enough fuel to survive the winter if they keep the supplies open with the folks in Iran. Fat chance, he says. If his good friend the Shah is overthrown, he doubts that his other good friends, the enemies of the Shah, will be so forthcoming, and his new good friends, China, won't be able to supply anything until spring. He calls a Yuletide energy alert, yay, he calls it, asking Americans to conserve energy by turning off their Christmas lights. He brings in Lorraine as his daughter, Amy, to officially unlight the Christmas tree, which was only lit on Wednesday. Amy turns a big switch that turns the Christmas tree light off. We see a clip of the, I think it's the tree being turned on, but aired in reverse. Lorraine gives the live from New York. I thought this was really, really good, and I thought it was made 10 times better by this very raucous and excited crowd. Aykroyd's Carter's always good. I really like Amy as played by Lorraine, though there is some issues with the little kid being in the sketch. I think she was played in a very inoffensive way here. So yeah, pretty good cold open. A lot of energy.
I thought Lorraine was pretty good. I enjoyed it too. Carter still works for me. It's always an impression that makes me chuckle. I thought it was a little clunky at the end there with the prop or something. But I thought Lorraine made me laugh, and it was just so hilariously evil to turn off the Christmas lights. Pretty good.
Yeah, it was a cute cold open, and I didn't have any issue with them having Lorraine as Amy. She was adorable. I liked it as a cold open.
Yeah, we have the monologue now. There's no band on stage except for Paul Schaefer at the piano. Elliot Gould comes down carrying some sheet music, and he gives it to Paul, and he dedicates it to his friends uptown, and he says, "You know who you are." He begins singing Louis Armstrong's classic Christmas Night in Harlem, but he's interrupted by a very dapper Garrett Morris. Garrett says he should be the one to sing it, or at the very least, Elliot Gould should sing it with Garrett. Both go into the song, they show their singing and dancing skills, and they finish the song and break for commercial. Elliot Gould, up to this point, has always done a musical intro when he hosts, and I've enjoyed every one of them. This one I thought was equally fun. It might not be as musical as the others, but it was pretty cool to have him and Garrett out there singing and dancing in this one. You know, it's both seasonally and geographically appropriate. I enjoyed this monologue a great deal, actually.
I thought they had some pretty sweet dance moves. I think Garrett was my favorite part of it, but it was kind of lame as an opener.
Well, I don't care for all the singing. I don't like too much singing in my comedy program. I thought it was schmaltzy and like really like phony network TV is kind of how it came off to me. It wasn't the cool show I came here to see. I didn't like it. Bad taste in me, though.
You enjoyed the first Elliot Gould, and they've all been diminishing returns for you, if I recall. You've liked each one less and less.
Truly, we'll see how it goes, but that seems to have been a pattern as of late.
Yeah. We now go to an ad for the Baby Norway all-flammable Christmas tree. We have Dan as a Ravco pitchman. There's a new product that's a small artificial tree that's built to burn. We see Bill and Lorraine as a couple who, after struggling with a blowtorch, burn the tree. She says it's just like a Yule log. The tree will burn for hours and then put itself out. It costs $29.95 and comes in three great colors. We then go back to Dan, and he burns all three colors of trees. Pardo says, order now and you'll get an all-flammable wreath. This was not too bad. You know, usually with these things, these ads, you can see some sort of twisted logic in there. I'm not seeing much twisted logic in this one or any logic at all beyond like your tree and your Yule log being the same. The biggest laugh for me in this thing was watching the crew guys put the fire out after the sketch was over. Beyond that, though, I was kind of disappointed in this one because I've been kind of waiting for it.
In my notes, Keith, I have the fire blankets and extinguishers were the best part.
Yep, agreed.
I felt like they just wanted to light some trees on fire, which, granted, is also pretty funny when it's little cheap plastic-looking Christmas trees. So, there. But, yeah, the best part was the crew trying to put out the fire they had lit.
Yeah.
I thought this was okay. It made me laugh. The premise, of course, is absurd. Dan is in his usual top form as this absurd character. And I was pretty surprised that they just kept lighting them bitches on fire and just letting them go up. They couldn't do that today. They wouldn't dare.
I wondered. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think they'd have such open flame in the zoo. And they weren't like particularly careful. Like Lorraine just stuck a torch in the thing.
It was not controlled.
No. They were like, fuck it. We're going to light a fire. So yeah, definitely a special effects sketch, if you will. I don't know. I still thought it was funny. It's stupid. I love these terrible products.
I don't know if the rules change. Remember that Great White concert where people were killed?
Oh, yes. Metro Club. Yeah.
I'm wondering if that changed, because before that we could have fires on stage and I haven't seen one since.
Interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, probably with an audience of that size and a building like that. Probably just against the rules now.
We're now off to the Wydettes, and this was written by Franken and Davis. It begins with Jane on the phone, and she's standing behind the counter speaking to Trans-American Airlines about her reservations. She then comes out from behind the counter, revealing a very large rear end. Her husband, Bob, plays by Dan, enters with an equally large bottom and brings in groceries because he's invited his brother to dinner. He also displays a glass sculpture that he bought at a shop. He had to pay for two because apparently he knocked one over off the shelf with his butt and broke it. John as Jeff and Gilda as Tammy enter as the kids. They also have large rear ends. Gilda's is also extremely weirdly shapen. John is very hungry, and Tammy says she's sad that she didn't make the cheer team. Elliot Gould enters as Uncle Jerry. He admires Gilda in her cheer suit and says she's turning into quite a real piece. Jeff says he has to go to the bathroom and wants to know where his copy of War and Peace is. We then hear a smoke alarm, and all of them decide to evacuate the house. Belushi comes running out of the bathroom with toilet paper hanging out of his pants. First thing that jumped out at me was Gilda's character is named Tammy Wynette. I mean, that's got to be a play on country star Tammy Wynette's name. Either way, this was just a completely ridiculous piece. It was 100% based on the cast wearing absolutely ridiculous costumes and hamming up a scene as best they can. They were definitely all in as a group for this, and they obviously had fun. Jane actually mentions this as something she just really enjoyed doing because it was so stupid. There were a few bad puns in the sketch, or a few puns in the sketch. Some the audience got, some the audience missed. All things considered, there wasn't much to this beyond the absolute ridiculousness. So I kind of have to say this was so-so. I did laugh, but I don't know, this early in the show, kind of weird.
Yeah, I agree. It's like there wasn't, why was the smoke alarm going off? Why did they all leave? Nothing really made sense. And not in a wacky, not making sense way. It just didn't make sense. I did enjoy everyone's giant butts. They were amusing.
This was absolutely dead on arrival for me. As soon as I saw that fucking butt and heard Wydette, I'm like, okay, I know what's up. I kind of felt like they were, it felt like cool city people poking fun at the Midwest at times too, with their accents and their mac and cheese. So yeah, a bunch of Midwest fat asses. I didn't like it. I thought it was kind of classist and not funny, but just really stupid.
It had a vibe of something that would come out of a high school, like a drama class or something, and the teacher would say, you can't do that. So I got curious and I checked, and Dan was definitely in his Wydette costume for the tree commercial. He just had a big coat over it, and I kind of wondered if he might have had it on for the Jimmy Carter bit as well, which might have gotten some of the laughter that we got from the beginning, but he definitely had it on for the tree commercial. We're now off to Don't Look Back by Peter Tosh, Jamaican reggae star. His most recent album was Bush Doctor, and that was released on Rolling Stone's record. It peaked at 104 on the US charts. This was written by Smokey Robinson, originally done by the Temptations. So Peter Tosh begins playing Don't Look Back. He is then joined by Mick Jagger, who performed vocals on the album with Tosh. The SNL band is in on this, a great sax solo from Lou Marini. I really liked a few versions of this song, including this one. It's a very, very nice song. The only knock is that I kind of thought Mick's stage histrionics or his bouncing and kicking the legs were kind of a tad annoying along with this song, but I think that's just Jagger and how he kind of has to do it. I don't know if Jagger was a surprise to the audience or not, but they definitely seemed happy to see him.
Yeah, I was not expecting Mick Jagger to show up, so that was kind of a neat surprise. I also noted, like, he's very all over the place, and, like, even Peter Tosh kind of, like, looked over at him a few times, like, dude, what the heck?
Yeah.
But I enjoyed the song.
It was pretty fun. I don't listen to this kind of music a lot. I mean, I dig it. I'm mellow, you know, I'm cool. I can get with it. I like Mick Jagger at his absolute cartoonish best. I find it really entertaining. This is my preferred Mick Jagger when he's an absolute caricature of himself. You know, pick this up and move it into the early 90s, and this is just like the impression of him you see on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
So I didn't love the song, but great performance. And Mick Jagger has a really poor sense of personal space.
He does. I mean, at least he wasn't tonguing him like he did Ronnie Wood, but yeah.
But yeah, like when he got all up in Peter Tosh's microphone and everything too, it was like, whoa, slow down there, dude.
I officially became old watching that because I was sitting there and I literally said out loud without any thought, Mick Jagger's got ants in his pants. I finally felt like an old man saying that.
That's great.
We now head to Mommy Dearest, and this is a parody of Christina Crawford's sensational memoir about her mother, Joan Crawford, known as Mommy Dearest. Book is still talked about today. It's still seen as one of the most defamatory, whether it was true or not, tell-all memoirs. Went on to be the basis of a movie a few years later, starring Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford. And the movie took the sensationalism to an even bigger level. So this sketch has Jane reprising her role as Joan Crawford. We saw in an earlier sketch, The Face Bank. It also stars Gilda as Colleen, as her Colleen Furman character playing Christina. So we see an insanely abusive and neglectful Crawford who will ask her daughter for hugs and kisses, only to get angry when her lipstick is messed up and her clothing gets wrinkled. Crawford threatens to cut Christina out of her will, which she actually does in real life. Crawford walks Colleen, through the steps for greeting the guests, when they come. There's some funny bits here where Jane is so graceful and Colleen is completely uncoordinated and foolish. We then get our first prominent bit from Yvonne Hudson as Crawford's maid Beulah. She announces that Archer Armstrong, a reporter from The Hollywood Reporter, has arrived. And that is Elliot Gould, who comes in and has a funny exchange with Colleen. Joan gives Colleen her Christmas present. It's the previous night's supper, which she didn't eat. Lorraine, Dan, and Bill enter as Katharine Hepburn, Clark Gable, and Cary Grant. Hepburn tries to get the dirt from Colleen on how many men Joan Crawford sleeps with. Gets Colleen to tap her foot multiple times to indicate, because Colleen won't speak. Colleen taps her foot many, many times. Clark Gable gives Colleen a pound of raw chuck. He was going to get her a pony, but her mother said not to. And then Cary Grant gives her 2 pounds of liver. He was going to take her to the circus, but her mother said not to. Joan Crawford then holds an Oscar, which is actually a flask of liquor. She says that her best role ever was as Christina's mother. We then cut back to an older Christina writing a letter to her deceased mother, thanking her for being the source of her best-selling book, Mommy Dearest. Lot to unpack with this one. It was a long sketch. This is a shot at, look, there's two ways to look at it. This is either a shot at Crawford or a shot at Christina for writing the memoir, which was pretty much widely disputed. Christina Crawford was pretty much regarded as having written a book of fiction and accused of trying to cash in on her late mother's fame. Through that lens, it's easier to poke fun at the abuse and the neglect and to understand why the Colleen character was used to be Christina. The impersonations were all very good. The audience was all in. We'd seen Lorraine and Bill's impressions before. Bill's is okay. Lorraine's is awesome. But Aykroyd, who looks nothing like Gable, actually looked like Clark Gable with very little done to his face. But the real story of this sketch is Jane's Joan Crawford. She was brilliant playing a shallow, unhinged, abusive, insane Crawford. You know, years later, Faye Dunaway will be lauded for a serious performance of this character. And it's really not that far from Jane Curtin's. The sketch was a tad long and a bit bloated. I thought maybe the Gould bit could have been cut because the impressions were a lot stronger. I've really been waiting for this sketch to come up. Last time I had seen it, I wasn't as familiar with either. I hadn't seen the movie and I still haven't read the book. But unfortunately, like with this, other than little bits and pieces here, I didn't laugh a lot, I guess, other than kind of the impressions and some of the ridiculousness, but I can definitely appreciate Jane's performance in this sketch.
Yeah, I can see where you feel that about it. I actually really liked it. Again, mostly because of the impressions. I could have had no Elliot Gould in it, but I could have watched Jane be Joan Crawford for literally days. She was incredible. And I would watch her be crazy and graceful and crazy over and over again.
Jeez, Elliot's out here borderline ruining everything he's in. Just kidding, but he's clearly like what a waste of space he is here. But much like Adrian, I really liked it too. Performances were strong enough that they really just carried me through so that I could feel it was long, but I never really felt bored. I was always just interested in watching Jane, and Gilda was funny enough. It's pretty big. It's pretty ambitious. What a missed opportunity in this life we've had for Jane not to play some sort of villainous Disney horrible woman. Her and Gilda, great comedy duo, this episode especially. I was so into it that I actually spent the next 2 hours online reading about Joan Crawford and her sad ending to life and stuff like that. I went right down the rabbit hole with it. So that's a great success in my book.
Yeah, same. I did the same thing, Matt. And I loved Lorraine's portrayal of Katharine Hepburn as well, but I enjoyed Jane's portrayal so much that I did actually go and learn more about Joan Crawford.
You know, even Betty Davis, who was a lifelong hater of Joan Crawford, said the book was ridiculously bad. You know, it was just, it did not portray that person. I wanted to mention Yvonne Hudson. She appears in this sketch as the maid. She worked in production, or she was a secretary. She had a few different jobs backstage, I believe. She made a lot of appearances here and there, but this was like her first prominent bit. She's later going to be promoted to a featured player in season 6 and is the first Black female to be a part of the regular cast. Most of her roles were few and far between. She's kind of completely disappeared off the map since then, to the point that even some of her cast members from season 6 aren't sure if she's still alive or not. But yeah, it was nice to see Yvonne Hudson finally having some lines. Weekend update. The audience is absolutely delighted to see this. We get an image of what looks to be Eastern European immigrants, and they're said to be refugees from Cleveland arriving in New York. Day before, Cleveland had defaulted on a bunch of loans totaling $15 million. The second thing I have here is Bill's mic sucks. There's an image of people praying, and it's said to be people ordered by the Shah to find his contact lens. The night before, Studio 54 was raided by the IRS. And wouldn't you know, they found some drugs. Lorraine reports from outside Studio 54, John Belushi plays Steve Rubell, and he's got a bunch of white powder on his upper lip, and he says he was shocked that cocaine was found there. He says it's a place where beautiful people come and dance and have fun, and he didn't know drugs were there all along. It must have been going on right under his nose. Lorraine makes sure that she's still able to get in. Belushi reveals that all along he's been eating a powdered sugar donut. Bill sings a happy 208th birthday to Beethoven, to a bastardized version of the Fifth Symphony. They then talk about the quote of the year, and Tony Orlando said, "If you could put all the laughs Bob Hope has gotten one after the other, they would stretch out all the way out to the universe and fill up the black hole in space." The reaction to that comment is awesome. And there's now a Clark Kent costume for Boring Children. Dan does a report about U.S. diplomatic relations, and it turns into a point-counterpoint with Jane as pro, Dan as anti. Jane says Dan's ability to ignore reality is a result of him being a paranoid schizophrenic, and it's all likely based on childhood trauma. Dan begins, of course, with "Jane, you ignorant slut," and he argues that liking China is turning its back on Taiwan, and the U.S. shouldn't act like Jane does in her personal life by jumping from bed to bed and being with whoever will have her. Rosanna Dana got a Christmas card from Kevin Federer in New Jersey, and she's going to do a report on increased suicide rates around the Christmas season. Kevin included a poem about wanting to kill himself. She says that she was depressed at Christmas the previous year, so she treated herself to a snappy time and went to Elaine's restaurant. She got to see celebrities with spaghetti sauce in the corner of their mouths. If they don't wash it, it starts to look like a blotch. Lee Radswell was there, and she came out of the bathroom dressed like a doll, but she had a piece of toilet paper stuck to her shoe. Roseanne goes on about how gross it was. Jane then cuts her off and reminds her that she's supposed to talk about being depressed at Christmas. Roseanne says you can either be depressed at Christmas or you can have toilet paper on your shoe. Roseanne surprises Jane with a piece of fruitcake. As Jane goes to eat the cake, she finds a hair. And then Roseanne compares life to a fruitcake and mentions the green things that you don't know what they are. I thought this was a very strong update. The highlight by far being the Studio 54 thing with Belushi. It also had a lot of really good jokes, a great counterpoint, and an okay Rosanna Dana. I don't think I'm a fan.
Yeah, I enjoyed this weekend update as well. The powdered donut was not what I was expecting to have happen, and it was beautiful. And then Lorraine still being like, I can still get in, right? That quote of the year was absolutely insane. I love point and counterpoint. I always love Jane, you ignorant slut. I don't know why, I just do. And Rosanna Dana, it's always something. And yeah. As much as I hate to love her, I can't help but love her.
I was a little disappointed that Lorraine was neither in reporter mode or disco queen mode. anyway, and I said it last week as well, but I like how Bill really has settled in to the whole thing. He just keeps getting better. He's clearly more comfortable. And Jane is clearly extremely confident. And what else did I think? What a better use of Dan, better suited for this. And Jane just hammered out her argument. He was savage. The burns were sick. And the crowd is hot. It's like a wrestling crowd tonight. They were hooting and hollering for the last one, and they're piping off for this one. Yeah. I think it's just obvious that the show has found its identity. And, like, you know, it's the big hit show now. It's wild. It's must-watch TV. And, you know, even when Roseanne was talking, the love for Gilda they have for the character is wild. A hot crowd can really carry a segment.
Yeah, absolutely. When the show is good, it can do nothing wrong. When the show is bad, it can't do anything right. A couple of talking points here. First off, Belushi playing Steve Rubell. Many years before, future cast member Mike Myers will play it in a performance that you and I disagree on to this day, Matt.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
You hated him in that, didn't you?
Yeah, I did not like it. Thought it was bad.
I hated the movie and thought he was great. I think you liked the movie and hated him, wasn't it?
It's been a while. I don't hold that movie in any sort of high esteem.
Oh, okay.
to say the least. I barely remember it. So I don't want to stand by anything.
Would you like to know how sleazy the world can be?
Always.
Always.
Okay. In Miller and Shales's book, Live from New York, photographer Edie Baskin recalls the day after Belushi passed away, someone called her to ask if she had any pictures with John Belushi with the powder under his nose from this sketch to put in the newspaper the day after his passing.
That's cold.
She didn't comply. But how 70s tabloidy is that, eh?
It's an impressive level of 70s tabloid.
It's a new level. I mean, no, it's not a new level, but you're right. It's just that's overly gross. Jesus Christ. I'm glad she didn't. I mean, she seems like a classy person and didn't go for it. But I could totally see that image of him with the smile and the sugar donut under his nose being on every friggin' newsstand in the country. We're now off to Alcoholic Christmas. This one's written by Brian McConaughey. Elliot Gould begins sleeping on the street at Christmas Eve. Dan enters in full Scottish regalia. He wakes Gould up and introduces himself as the spirit of blended Scotch whiskey. Each Christmas, the alcohol spirits come to life to help a mortal, and this year they've picked Elliot Gould. Dan needs to find out if he knows the meaning of Christmas cheer. Gould makes some pure guesses about family and Jesus and stuff, but Dan says he'll have to get his friends out to remind Gould what Christmas is all about. Belushi comes in dressed in some traditional English garb, introduces himself as the spirit of Christmas gin that goes best with vermouth and tonic, but can also go well with aquavelva and battery acid. Garrett comes in a fox hunting garb, and he plays whiskey, which can be best carried in a paper bag in the back pocket. Gould thinks they're there to help him stop drinking. Dan says Gould has already lost too much, and his life can only get better by incessant drinking. Belushi says the liver isn't a gland or an organ. It's a muscle that has to be worked out. Dan says Gould should strive to have a big nose with big manly veins. Gould gets their point and says that in order to be, you have to be yourself. And if you're a drunk, you should be a drunk on Christmas. Dan then walks over to reveal a street band and starts singing a song that talks about the values of drinking. After the song, Dan rejoins Gould and uses his magic to turn the light on at a liquor store next to where Gould was sleeping. This was a good idea. Spirit of Christmas. It's a fun pun, but I thought this was actually quite weak. This is another one I was kind of looking forward to. I'm surprised that so many that I was looking forward to are all in this episode. I found Garrett struggled a lot in this sketch, and the sketch kind of had a great idea. It never really progressed beyond the setup stage. The song was not good. It was hard to make out. And I did like the look of the band, but this sketch never got out of first gear. And other than the great costumes and the really good use of the snow machine and a pretty cool set, there was really nothing to this. I really was disappointed.
Yeah, I didn't care for this at all, except the costumes. Loved the costumes. That Beefeater outfit was phenomenal, but didn't like the sketch at all. The premise could have been good, but it wasn't. It really did nothing for me.
Elliot Gould sucks. He's not good at anything tonight. You talk about diminishing returns, man. You said it. This is a pretty bad Christmas sketch. When it didn't annoy me, it depressed the hell out of me. I think I get what they were trying to do, but complete disaster. I feel like this is the kind of, they were like, oh, we got to have something for Elliot to do. And so they have to, you know, come up with shit like this. Anyway, anything he's in tonight, I'm not enjoying.
I put none of this on Elliot Gould at all. I don't know what they were going for. I mean, I've enjoyed all of McConaughey's stuff up to this one. I think sometimes when you go dark, you have to be extra funny or extra dark, and they weren't. This was almost making fun of, in a way.
Can we blame Elliot Gould for that?
I don't want to, but you guys can.
Yeah, I'm blaming him. I'm blaming him a little.
All right. In season one, you blamed everything bad on Al Franken, I think. So it's good to...
I need me scapegoat.
We're now off to Bob and Ray, and we've got Ray Goulding and Bob Elliott. So this pair met working in Boston radio, and their comic banter and their comic sensibilities really meshed. And by 1946, they had their own show in Boston, which aired 6 days a week. Both were brilliant improvisers, and they really excelled at presenting even the most ridiculous pieces in very serious manners. They were among the first to satirize radio and then to satirize television, and among the first to parody things like soap operas and game shows. They made the jump to television in 1951. To put it in context, it's the same year Lucy went up and a year before The Honeymooners did. They still worked on radio as well. There'll be a lot more to say about Bob and Ray later in this series, later in the season when there's a special, but they were absolute pioneers. They influenced generations of comedians, and their influence is now at the point where people are doing Bob and Ray stuff without realizing where it kind of came from. It's their dead serious manner of delivery and their choice in materials. Bob Newhart, David Letterman, George Carlin, Jay Leno, Kurt Vonnegut openly say that Bob and Ray were big influences on them. But also, like, I've never heard these names mentioned, but I can totally see, like, your Norm MacDonald, your Buck Henrys, your Jon Stewart's, Conan, Colbert, Carell, all those guys definitely seem to have some degree of what Bob and Ray were doing. Not to mention that like 80% of SNL or more is a direct take off of what they were doing. Bob's son is actually Chris Elliott, who goes on to be a cast member, granddaughter Abby Elliott. So we have three generations of Elliots having appeared on the show. And in a weird twist that I just found about some trivia here, Chris Elliott wrote a book about his father that parodies parts of Mommy Dearest, where Chris makes these outlandish claims and Bob refutes them in the book. So just thought I'd give a little bit of info about Bob and Ray there. Any thoughts about the bio before we get into what they do? I mean, these guys are big names that don't get their due.
Yeah, well, that was a great bio right there. Thank you for that. I hadn't heard of Bob and Ray before this, and I know I'm getting into it before we get into the sketch, but I loved them. Loved them. They were like an Abbott and Costello, yeah, Wayne and Schuster kind of vibe, and I would have preferred Bob and Ray to be longer and not had that previous sketch.
Agreed.
Yeah, this is that was pretty interesting. It's news to me. It's certainly, I mean, I'm curious about it. And, I mean, I guess I should say more after the sketch. Let me reserve comment.
Just as a testament, after Ray passed away, Ray is the bigger fellow and Bob was still working. Bob Newhart, on his show Newhart, he cast Bob to play his father on an episode. I can totally see why. So let's go into the sketch here. So Bob and Ray are sitting at a set with two chairs. Bob talks about going through bus depots to try to find people to help out at Christmas time. Ray plays a man who was sitting at the bus depot and looked very depressed. Ray says that on Labor Day, he was having some drinks with his friends at his home back in Tacoma. And he thought a New York City Christmas tree should come from the Pacific Northwest because they have such great trees. So he chopped down a tree and got on a bus and went all the way to New York with a few stops along the way. As he's talking, there's a tree revealed, which is very small and very bare, but he had to keep it on his lap for the trip. And he notes that, you know, in just their banter back and forth, he notes that there's a right way and a wrong way to go through a bus door when carrying a tree. He has come all the way to New York to try to sell the tree. And he ran into a man who sent him to see newscaster John Chancellor to try to sell him the tree. There was already a New York City Christmas tree already that he hadn't noticed. Unfortunately, poor Ray couldn't sell the tree anywhere. So Bob wants to make his Christmas a good Christmas. He feels bad for him. Ray says he doesn't want tears. He has something else that will save his Christmas. He leaves and we hear a smash, and he comes back in with a old box of Christmas decorations. Turns out that he was a glass blower by trade and made some ornaments that he was going to sell for $1,200 a piece, but he unfortunately broke them. With his Christmas now on the brink of ruin, Bob gives him a carpenter's extension ruler to cheer him up for the holidays. This was very funny. This was great banter. I've come across Bob and Ray stuff a few times over the years. Always a lot of fun. Always seems like two fellas just sitting there chatting. You can very easily miss some of the humor, but when you're tuned into what they're saying, it's always hilarious. Really, really, really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I loved it. And actually, John was upstairs while I was watching this part of the episode, and he laughed out loud at the right way and a wrong way to put a tree through a bus door, because there is.
Yeah, but a lot of fun. These guys have such great chemistry together. It really just felt like they were having this great, easy back and forth conversation, sitting around the table having tea. The bit with the tree and him talking about carrying around the tree, holy shit, it was really funny thinking of him carrying the tree in his lap all over the country. Yeah, I got a lot of laughs out of it. I thought it felt a little long for me toward the end, but for the most part, I really enjoyed it, especially, which one was the host, the guy without the tree?
Bob is
the host.
In March of 79, during one of Saturday Night Live's off week, there is a special called Bob and Ray, and I might have the name order wrong, Jane and Lorraine and Gilda, that I hope we can cover when the time comes.
Yeah, for sure. Let's dig it up.
Adrian, will you join us?
I'd love to. I loved Bob and Ray.
They do a spoken word version of Rod Stewart's Do You Think I'm Sexy?
Oh my God. I'm so in.
We now go to St. Mickey's KOC, another one written by Brian Doyle Murray. And we've seen this one once before. It starts with Belushi as the Grand Knight Frank Leary, and he introduces Garrett as Father Bob Kimbutu from Tanzania, a guest priest who's there to deliver a prayer. Dan Aykroyd is then brought up as Deputy Grand Knight Jack Niehauser for a special report. He cracks an awkward joke about Leary buying a 2x4. The joke is not funny. Dan Aykroyd's delivery was hilarious. He gives a report on the Christmas banquet with spaghetti, but he won't read the financial report because it's Christmas, but he tries to get people moving the raffle tickets. He mentions Phil Burke, played by Brian McConaughey, is having sold 93 of them. Leary talks about the toy drive to send toys to Tanzania. Unfortunately, a bunch of them were broken, but shoot, I didn't write the name down, but a character played by Brian Doyle Murray is a toy salesman who took care of them. Father Kimbutu has some slides, and he wants to show people what life is like in Tanzania. Leary seems leery and says that the Boy Scouts broke the slide projector the previous night, so instead these slides can be passed around and held up to the light, and they are then thrown out to audience members. Lorraine appears as Sister Serena. She is the coach of the basketball team, and she accepts an award for the team finishing second place in a tournament, but she also has to explain herself for coming in second, as it's the first time in 50 years that the team has not won. Leary then has to present the award to the Temple Bethel team, coached by Milt the Stilt Finkel, played by Elliot Gould. He says it was a fine tournament and both had fine teams, but his team was good and their team lacked stamina, drive, and the ability to defend. Bill again comes in playing Leary's goofball son, who won tournament MVP. Leary then calls out the girls from the kitchen, played by Jane and Gilda, and he gives them each a bottle of wine. They close the meeting by singing Little Town of Bethlehem. Nobody knows the words after the first bits. They then try to sing Noel, and they don't know the words either. Then they try Good King Wenceslas, and the only one that knows all the words is Jewish Mr. Milt the Stilt. They then end the meeting by saying the bar is open. Like the first St. Mickey's, the one that had Chico Escuela, this one is not laugh out loud funny, but it is so real, and its realness to me is hilarious. I've been at a meeting not unlike this, 2 days ago. I preferred the first one. This one was good too. There were little touches in here that made it really funny, like Dan's character pawed at Gilda when she came out to accept her bottle of wine. She raps his knuckles. What really blew me away though at this sketch was when the camera pulled back and it revealed how small the set was. It legitimately looked like a big hall as I was watching the sketch, and it hadn't occurred to me that it would have only been small. I mean, the set's only about 10 or 12 feet wide. So it really kind of goes to show how good the camera work and the visual production has gotten since season one. I laughed at this. I enjoyed it. But again, it's not really laugh out loud funny as much as it's like continual smile of recognition and a little bit of cringe in there too. What did you guys think? I'm always curious about sketches like this when it comes to you.
I thought the exact same thing as you, Keith. I was slightly uncomfortable because it was every single union meeting or board meeting or church group meeting that I've been to. The set, the people there, the thanking the church ladies, bad jokes, everything about it I've seen in real life. And it was kind of frightening.
I like this. As you might recall, Keith, I did not care for the previous installment of this sketch. But this one I found, I don't know, there was something, I thought it was paced better. I just found it a little faster moving, and I ended up, and I definitely enjoyed it more. I wasn't sitting there laughing my ass off, but I was able, I think, because of the faster pace, to appreciate the realism a little more, and the and the zany characters involved. And oh my God, when he corrected him with the tickets, it was a laugh out loud moment for me. I actually enjoyed it quite a bit, and it was a big step up for me.
And the line about the Boy Scouts breaking the projector, I think I've used at Girl Guides to get the girls to not try to use something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know your background, Adrian, and you definitely sat through a lot of these over the
years. Like so many of these. I've been the one serving the food at these sorts of situations. So
getting caught by the Jack Niehausers of the world.
This is very familiar territory.
They say good art is a mirror of society, but this is just this mirror is too shiny, too clear.
A little unsettling.
Another thing I thought of is something I learned years ago when I was doing a comedy workshop. Someone said the testament of a good comic is the ability to tell a joke poorly. And if that's the case, Dan Aykroyd is a genius. For him to tell that joke as badly as he did, the guy's got real chops.
Oh, it was perfect. It was exactly how it would have been told in one of those meetings.
No question about it, yeah. The finance guy trying to be funny, you know. We're now off to the second performance by Peter Tosh. It's Bush Doctor. This is from the album of the same name. Song about legalizing marijuana in Jamaica, but really everywhere. This was a great song. It was way ahead of its time as far as being featured on mainstream media. And I kind of have a theory that this got through the censors because he was singing, you know, legalized marijuana in Jamaica. If he was just saying legalized marijuana, they might not have let it on. But because it's in Jamaica, he slipped it past the censors. I really enjoyed this. And I think this is a very important song for a lot of different reasons. Folks at High Times probably love this, but I really enjoyed the song. Thought it was great. Your reactions, I mean, certainly about the song, but what about a mainstream show like this, even though it is like 1 a.m. doing a song about marijuana in 1978? Holy shit.
I was really surprised that they let it happen, given other things that they have censored or banned people for, but I loved it. I was so glad it happened. They should have Peter Tosh more. He was great.
I thought it was rather risque or awfully forward to have just some guy on stage being like, yeah, legalize marijuana in that day and age, especially considering like how think about how pedestrian primetime is in this. When I say pedestrian, you know what I mean? Like borderline Puritan still. Like it's still very behind. And I mean, network TV always will be in its own way. It was definitely at least a generation behind by this point. Anyway, I digress. I thought the song was fine. This isn't the kind of music I listen to, but I do support the legalization of marijuana.
Well, even like that 70s show was 20 years later, and they never revealed that they were sitting around. I didn't really watch the show, but I know they had them scenes in the basement where the camera was going around, and they never indicated it was marijuana, did they, openly?
I don't think openly, no.
No, I mean, everyone knew it was, but I don't think they ever said it.
Yeah, and I know other times that there have been, you know, jokes about marijuana and weed that were, you know, you can do it, but don't say the word, you know. Our next sketch is Dubs Trees. So Elliot Gould plays a Christmas tree vendor who he sells a tree to Al Franken and a woman. As Elliot Gould moves a tree, we see Bill Murray's character Honker taking a leak in the corner. Gould stops him and tells him to go away. Murray says Joseph wouldn't have done that to the shepherds. Lorraine then comes in as one of the women from a massage parlor across the street, and she starts hitting on Gould. She said she needs a tree. He tells her to put on a pair of mittens, and she flashes him, getting a great reaction from the audience. He offers her a $15 tree. She says she'll take it if he'll carry it over. He won't do that. He won't leave his trees, but she offers him a 2-minute around the world, so he takes the tree. In the meantime, Honker has snuck back in to finish his bathroom break and is hiding in the corner again. Gilda and Jane come in as a mother and daughter, and not the way it's usually cast. They mistake Bill for the tree vendor. He talks about Santa's birds flying by and tells Jane's character that birds watch kids for Santa. Jane gets very interested in this. They then ask Bill to show them some trees, and he mentions that the long needle ones can poke your eyes out, so he sends them a classic fir for $10. Jane asks her mother if she will marry the man because he's very nice. He says they're going to have to date first. Gilda then asks him to carry the tree to the car and tie it to the roof, which Gould wouldn't do earlier for Franken. Bill says he could, but he doesn't have any twine. But because they're only 10 blocks away, he volunteers to sit on the roof and hold on to it. There's a lot of good in this sketch. First off, Gould and Lorraine were good. The real meat in this, though, is after Gould takes off. Murray's Honker, nice and charming character. Really fun seeing Gilda play the classy mother and Jane play the kid for a change. Great voice by Jane. There was just something nice and Christmassy about this, where Honker kind of gets one over on the sleazy tree owner. You know, I don't know if Gould was shown to be as sleazy as he possibly could have been, but at the end of the day, Honker made two new friends, Jane made a friend, and Honker walks away with 10 bucks that Elliot Gould's sleaze bag didn't get his hands on. So I actually really, really, really enjoyed this. It was nice and gritty New York Christmas for me.
I liked this one too. I liked getting to see Jane as the kid and Gilda as the mom. I liked the sketch better when Elliot Gould left, and Bill Murray was adorable. So, yeah. I also thought it was really funny how the Christmas tree kept falling over, and maybe it wasn't supposed to, but it tickled me.
We're all on pretty much the same page here. I thought it was a cute little Christmas bit, and yeah, it was really cool seeing Jane do the Gilda role, so to speak, if you will, and all that. And yeah, the voice was really funny, and what a shock. Everything picked up when Elliot Gould left.
This is the only time I'll admit to that this episode. So we go to the Good Knights. Gould says that they're not ready for primetime players, which they haven't been called in at least this season. They're certainly ready and have been ready for some time. He calls them the most talented people he's ever worked with. Dan then comes up and tries to schoolboy John Belushi for some weird reason. Bob and Ray and Tosh's band are all out on the stage. Lorraine seems to go back to tie her shoe, and Belushi escapes before Dan. So, I mean, those little moot points are some interesting things I noticed during the Good Nights. Anything you guys noticed?
Just that Elliot Gould rubbed me the wrong way and acting like he was better than everyone. I don't know. I don't think I liked him.
The only thing I noticed is my agreement with Adrian's opinion.
I did not expect Elliot Gould hate tonight. I'm sorry. All right, so let's rate this show. The host... For me, Elliot Gould is always good. Some of his episodes like this one are not really the best, but I think he's there for a reason, and I think he did quite well tonight. Improperly used a few times, perhaps, but I thought he was really energetic, really immersed with the cast. My complaint is I really didn't get much memorable from him this time. I liked his monologue, but I liked it as much because Garrett was there. He was good with what was given. That's where I'm sitting on Elliot Gould, and I know I'm going to be in the minority. Go ahead, one is.
Yeah, no, I didn't like him. He felt like he was acting like he was too cool for the rest of them, like he was better than everyone, and then he wasn't even the best part of any sketches. So, I don't know, he just really rubbed me the wrong way, and I guess that's too bad. Sorry, Elliot Gould.
Boo, Elliot Gould. He added nothing to the show tonight. He detracted from the show tonight. You know what? Is it all his fault? I don't care. It's not my business. I don't work on the big network TV show. I don't get to do all the cool stuff and the parties and go to the disco. I just sit here doing a service to the public. This is like the lowest grade I've given a host in some time. Not that we actually grade it, but this is certainly my I'm really I'm squinting.
I'm picturing you pointing at the camera and or pointing at the computer and just giving it to us like that old
I just again, like, I don't know if it was his fault, but it doesn't matter if it's his fault. Like Adrian said, he certainly didn't add anything to the show tonight. And I didn't find him particularly funny in anything he was in.
Music. Thought Peter Tosh was pretty darn good. First song was a lot of fun. Very bouncy cover of a song that's covered a lot, but it's different a lot from all the other covers. I enjoyed it. A nice surprise guest by Jagger, whether it was surprise or not. He did kind of have his idiosyncrasies in there, which were kind of obnoxious, but still made for a good performance. Second song, good song. A bit of a novelty to see this message as early as it was. And I enjoyed Peter Tosh. I thought it was a very, very good choice to host, and I thought he did, or musical guest, and I thought he did great.
Yeah, he was a perfect musical guest. There was a little bit of politics in there with the second song, a little bit of extra star power with Mick Jagger, and both songs were funky. So, hey, good times.
I don't think they knew about Mick Jagger, the audience, that is, because I mean, I know they probably would have said something when they were, they probably would have woohooed when he came out in the first place. But, you know, after all the years of watching the sports entertainment, I can read a pop. And I think that was a surprise. But yeah, you know how much I loved that cartoonish oaf dancing around and mugging and running and taking his shoes off and just being an ass. That's why I love him. That's the version of him that I love the most. When he's earnest and serious, I'm less inclined. I'm not interested. But yeah, holy shit. As for the actual guy, I keep losing my train of thought. It was fine. I don't like that kind of music, but I think it's a good choice. I would book this for my cool late night show for the kids. Of course, all them dope smokers that watch our late night show, oh, they're gonna love this. Let's get this guy.
So what was the worst sketch of the night, gang?
Alcoholic Christmas. That was the worst sketch of the night. 100%.
I second that motion, sir. Alcoholic Christmas was annoying and depressing and just an irritation start to finish.
That's a definite sweep. I actually wrote, Adrian, I wrote yours in before you even said it in my little spreadsheet here.
Perfect. And,
it wasn't even close for me. So what was the best sketch of the night? I'm going to let you know I didn't include Bob and Ray, but you guys are certainly more than welcome to.
I wasn't going to include Bob and Ray, so I'm going to keep it that way. I would have to say that my best sketch of the night, excluding Bob and Ray, is Mommy Dearest, because it was Jane. Mm-hmm. Jane sold it for me. Something about Mommy Dearest really worked for me. And then I went down my Joan Crawford rabbit hole. So I learned things because of it. There we go. Mommy Dearest.
Yep, that's another agreement with me and she tonight. I thought it was excellent. I was glued to the whole thing. Couldn't believe how good Jane was. You know, considering how long it was for, you know, to be able to sit through it like that and not get irritated or bored. It's quite an accomplishment. They're definitely doing it right.
I went a different way. I think I enjoyed it the least of the three of us. I went with Dubs Trees. Short, to the point, gritty New York vibe. I really like this. Like I said, the bad guy Gould loses a tree. In return, he gets a treat at a massage parlor. Gilder and Jane get a service with a smile, and Honker walks away with $10 and two new friends. Kind of sweet in a piss-stained sort of way is what I wrote.
Very good. Very fairy tale of New York style thing.
Exactly what I was thinking of. Also during the Harlem song, Christmas Night in Harlem, I was like, was this the New York Christmas song before the Pogues, you know?
Maybe it was.
Who was your star of the night?
It was Jane. Jane got to be Joan Crawford and a little girl and got to be super mean in point counterpoint.
I thought it was a landslide victory for Jane. She was everywhere. She was different. She was awesome. And yeah, I thought it was a no-doubter.
I have to be that guy tonight, I guess. I went with Dan. He was everywhere, even more so than Jane, I thought. His Carter at the beginning was great. His pitch man was fine, though I didn't quite get the purpose of the trees. The Wydette father made me laugh. He tried his best with Alcoholics Christmas. He was great in Update. I just really enjoyed Dan tonight. Jane was a very close second, but I went with Aykroyd again.
I guess my counterpoint to that would be, and I don't make them often, so I'll make it now, because I think it's wild that you didn't pick Jane. Dan, it was just like the same old shit. Dan didn't do anything new or interesting, and you even like even in talking about it, you mentioned that he tried to save something, and I think when somebody comes out and does something so like Jane was like radically different tonight, you're gonna regret this vote, young man.
Yeah, I do regret them from time to time, but I think I'm pretty good with this one. Like even Dan's Clark Gable was
I did point at the laptop that time too.
Overall, this was not a top tier show, and it was kind of a let down to me. The energy was bottomed out this week on screen. The writing just wasn't there. Other than Update and Bob and Ray, there was nothing absolutely excellent. Like, the Wydettes are silly. I like them for that, but there's not much there. St. Mikey's is not laugh out funny, but it's so bloody real it feels good. I did like the monologue. I enjoyed Mommy Dearest to a point. And even Dubs Trees, which I like, is going to be a weaker entry in the ones in my favorites of this year. The music I thought was very, very good. I was let down by this episode. Some of it is expectations for sketches I was waiting to see. All things considered, I wound up giving this one a 5 out of 10.
I also gave it a 5. And given what I liked, it's hard to justify it being so low. But the stuff that I disliked, I really disliked. 5 just felt fair and maybe even a bit generous at times. But then I think of like Peter Tosh, I'm like, maybe it's not. But I'm sticking with my 5.
I think y'all are being a little too hard on this show. I know Elliot Gould was bad, but he wasn't that bad. The cold open was good, and I didn't like the monologue, but there was a good ad. We had the Mommy Dearest sketch, which, the crowd was popping for that during that. And Weekend Update was like an Attitude Era Raw with the hooting and the hollering and the chanting for your favorites almost. Yeah, I thought it was really good. And shit, what else did I like? The two fellas, Bob and Bob Ray. And the music was good. So when I think about that, like that stupid ass sketch with the big asses, that was ridiculous. And I didn't like the alcoholic Christmas. But other than those things and thinking that the host was just not good, I really thought the show had a lot of fire and its good moments. So I'm going to go 6.5.
So with my 5, Adrian's 5 and Matt's 6.5, we average out at a 5.5, which is pretty low. The folks at IMDb kind of agree with us all, Adrian and I probably more. This is the second worst episode of the season based on their ranking. They gave it a 6.2. Their choice for worst is still yet to come. So it's not a highly regarded episode, so I don't think we're too far off the mark there.
And we know who to blame.
Yeah.
Do we? But I really think, and, you know, it's really weird. I feel like I should comment, because for me to end up with the highest score is kind of slightly anomalous.
Yep.
But I don't mean it in that way, because I generally enjoy the show. Mm-hmm. But others may disagree. Anyway, I digress. I really think that the highs of this show were really high. And I guess I'm just saying that to justify what I was thinking. Do I feel the same without a hot crowd? I don't know. We'll never have to find out.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I can't help but think that part of it for me is, you know, there's two sketches here that I've been kind of waiting for, and neither one of them really hit the mark for me. So there's that as well. Matt, do you know who next week's host and musical guest are?
Oh, I forget. Go ahead and fill me in.
It's Michael Palin and the Doobie Brothers.
Oh, that sounds like a cool show.
Yeah, yeah. And Sean will be joining us for that one. Sean's back for that one. And it's our first episode of 1979. That's a big year for you and I, Matt.
Big year. Big year. That's when
Adrian, you were still a few years out, I think.
I'm not around yet, no. I've got a ways to go.
Matt and I will be back in about a week with Michael Palin, Doobie Brothers episode. But until then, we'll be turning off the Christmas lights here in SN Hell.